is going to be about black holes in Kaluza-Klein theory. So there's some quite interesting stories to be had here. So I'm going to focus on black holes that, from our 4D perspective, would have electric or magnetic charge. So typically we say that this extra dimensional motion in the extra dimension is analogous to electric charge. And the reason for that is that if we are moving in the extra dimension, that's like adding a T component here to the gauge field A. That's why we say it's associated to electric charge. But you might think, why is that the case? Because surely if nothing depends on the extra dimension, how can velocity in the extra dimension have meaning? Because after all, the first thing we kind of learn with relativity is that there's no notion, you know, there is no such thing as a rest frame. Well, that's not quite the case. So once we compactify, we actually do have a notion of a rest frame. So to see why this is the case, let's just kind of look at the effect of a Lorentz transformation in the extra dimension. So remember, our Kaluza-Klein compactification says, pick a length in chi, and you're identifying chi with chi plus L. But the subtext of that is that that identification takes place at a given time. So, what happens if we do a boost? If we look at a moving frame? Well, from the perspective of a space-time diagram, what happens is if we're looking at a moving observer, we have new coordinates, t prime and chi prime. Where the new coordinates are given by a Lorentz transformation. So if I ask, what is the equivalent of my cylindrical identification? Then that tells me that T prime has to be identified with T prime minus V gamma L, and chi prime has to be identified with chi prime plus gamma L. So we're now not doing an identification at constant T, but this point here, which is at T equals zero, T prime to zero, sorry, is not, has to be identified with this point over here, which is now at non-zero T. Sorry. And so the moral of this is, we can't gauge away that A. So once we've got a cross term, we can't just get rid of it with our identification. So we can see the consequences of this for the black hole solution. So we'll start by building a black hole from a very simple solution of five-dimensional gravity. And that is taking the four-dimensional black hole and simply translating it in a fifth dimension. So this solves the vacuum Einstein equations. So all I do is I take my four-dimensional Schwarzschild and just tack a flat dimension on. So here, your R4 would be 2G4M. So that's R. I've written it as R4 because I want to avoid giving it an interpretation of mass for the time being. And this, if you like, is just a simple black string. So it has a killing vector, which is d by dz. So it satisfies what we need for a Kaluza-Klein solution. And so if I was just wanting to think about what does that correspond to, if I compare it to that first line there on the board on the left, that would say, well, there's no dilaton, there's no scalar field, there's no gauge field, chi would be z, and my metric, g mu nu, would but just be the Schwarzschild metric. So this says that 4D Schwarzschild is a simple reduction of this five-dimensional black string by simply chopping a length of the black string and identifying the two ends. But what happens if we do a Lorentz boost? So all I've done here is I've simply said, well, let's just boost along the z direction. So I've changed coordinates from t to t prime, if you like, or I guess I've taken the opposite sign of v there. Now I'm going to identify z with z plus l at constant t. So in other words, I'm thinking, you know, my identification frame is one in which this black string is kind of moving in the z direction. So if I look at GZZ, for example, just by pulling together these two pieces, so I've obviously got a minus one from there. And then from this, I've got plus v squared. Then I've got minus r4v squared over r. So that's my gzz. And I can see I've got a common factor inside here of 1 minus v squared. So I can write this as a sort of Newtonian type of potential. So the z component of my metric here isn't flat anymore. And I can complete the square. So I'm now going to multiply out these two brackets and then group all the terms together so they look like that top line. So I complete the square with dz and dt. Thank you.
sorry. What do you mean by identify J to J plus L? I see no identification in the metric.
So what I'm saying is that if I didn't identify, I could just do a Lorentz transformation back to the original black string frame. So, so there would be no significance, if you like, to this particular coordinate transformation. But once I've made this identification at constant t, then that means that this is, if you like, a preferred rest frame. It's the frame in which my periodicity is purely in this spatial component. So this Z here that's appearing in the metric, this is, if you like, the real extra direction, because I know that if I walk in that direction, I just keep coming back to where I started. Although, of course, that implies a passage of time, but essentially, you know, I'm just saying if I go in this purely spatial direction along that extra dimension, I get back to where I started again and again, and I don't move in T. So if I multiply out, which is what I've done here, and rearrange, then here in this form, this is my Kaluza Klein, my real Kaluza Klein coordinate. So there is, this is a real gauge field, the real A mu. So you're correct that, you know, you don't see the identification in the components of the metric, but you see it in the significance of the Kaluza-Klein coordinate that you have. Because I can kind of always do, if I didn't have the identification, I could always unravel that gauge field by simply choosing the normal to point in a different direction. But if I do that after identifying, that means that I'm moving in time as well as that extra direction. So to finish off, I'm just going to change coordinates. Can't read what I've got here. So all I'm doing now is just finally shifting my coordinates, because I'd like to have something that looks familiar. So I'd like my GTT to look something like 2m hat on r hat. So I change, I shift the origin and rescale my radial coordinate. I define a new mass. I define a charge, which is going to mean that my A now looks like what you would expect for an electrostatic potential. And then I define my scalar field. So that's picking out what that scalar field is from the metric. So then my four-dimensional canonical Einstein frame metric this is the Kaluza-Klein electric black hole. So you notice that the way it's written, GTT and GRR are inverses, but we're no longer in the area gauge. So the area of our two spheres is not 4 pi r squared, it's less than 4 pi r squared. So you see there are things that are similar to the Riesner-Nordström black hole, but things that are different. So in Riesner-Nordström, all you do is you correct GTT by a Q squared on R squared piece, but you're still in the area gauge, and GTT is still 1 over GRR in magnitude. Whereas here, you've got this square root, which looks a little bit iffy. And you see that the area of the two spheres goes to zero when R goes to VQ. So looking at that, you deduce that there's going to be a singularity at R equals VQ that will be hidden behind an event horizon at R hat is 2 GM hat, provided that the event horizon occurs first, and so you kind of see that from looking at what the sort of relation between M and Q. So here, our extremal limit, we sort of always have this notion of a charge being less than or equal to some bound. And if I look at what the charge is, I'm just slightly concerned there might be a factor of 2 out here. But if I look at what the charge is, then the charge is V times M. So I can't go faster than the speed of light. So the limit on V is 1. So here, my extremal limit is when V goes to 1, and so Q is actually equal to M. Something that doesn't quite look right here, and I think it's my definition of M hat. So I apologize for that, I'm just going to correct it. So if M hat is R4 over 1 minus V squared, then this should be 1 minus M hat over R. Or if I write this 2 GM, let me do that. So I can leave that as that, and so that's V times 2 GM hat, there we go. Sorry, I was too, Q is 2 GM hat, there we go. So what happens in the extremal limit is this inner singularity moves out to meet the event horizon, and so we end up with a singular solution. So that's the Kaluza-Klein electric black hole, which is, you know, it is what it is, and it's, I think, you know, not necessarily got anything particularly interesting to recommend it. But that's not the case with the magnetic solution, which has a very interesting story. So I believe you've met David. Have they met the Ryson and Nordstrom solution?
Well, you have seen it.
Seen it? Yeah, okay, you've seen it once, therefore we assume you know it. So in four dimensions, if we just forget about Kaluza-Klein for a moment, we look for charged black hole solutions. So obviously we first try electric charge because that's our fundamental charge. And we see that we can adjust our Schwarzschild solution. So Rn is Ryson and Nordstrom solution. And GTT becomes 1 minus 2gm on R plus something like Q squared on R squared. So that's what happens. That's our electric solution. But then what gets kind of interesting is that in four dimensions, our energy momentum tensor which has the following structure, that is invariant under a duality transformation. So if I take the dual of F, remember this is the Hodge dual, which is that epsilon tensor, then I find that the energy momentum tensor doesn't care if I construct it out of F or F dual. So if I have an electric solution, I also have a solution where my Maxwell stress tensor looks like the dual of the electric solution. In other words, a magnetic solution. So my electric solution is Q over R squared dt by dr, and that kind of goes into Q sine theta d theta cross d phi. So from the geometry perspective, the geometry doesn't care whether you've got an FTR or an F theta phi. So that's kind of interesting. And if I look now at this potential, this field strength here, then this is what we would call a magnetic monopole. Why? Well, remember our B field let me say B I is star of F I. So remember, our two form in three real dimensions has a dual that's a one form. So our magnetic field is just epsilon ijk fjk. So if I have an F theta phi, then that corresponds to a BR. Now, normally, we don't write down a BR because that's a magnetic monopole, and we know that div B should be zero. So we don't expect there to be a monopole. But if I look here at the Maxwell equations, DF is zero because it only depends on theta. The sort of components only depend on theta. So that's fine. And you see that F is just the area form on the two sphere. So it's topological in nature. So then we might ask, well, if we have this duality, electric-magnetic duality, can we find a gauge potential for our B, our F? So if I look here, I can sort of see how I might integrate up, because sine theta d theta is just d of cos theta up to a sine. So it looks like if I take d of cos theta d phi, I should get my magnetic potential. Integrate up from theta equals zero. Integrate f. If I integrate f from theta equals zero, I get this gauge potential. A is q1 minus cos theta d phi. So if I take d of that A, I get f. So this is regular theta equals zero, which of course it should be, because that's where I integrated from. But it's not regular on the negative z-axis. So I can write a gauge potential, but it's not a regular gauge potential. So
what do you mean by not regular?
Well, when I go down to theta equals pi, this A is 2q d phi. And d phi is not defined on the axis. So it's not a regular gauge field. Its components in a locally regular frame are blowing up. However, if I define a different gauge potential, by integrating up from the south at pole axis, this is what I would get. And that is regular on at theta equals pi, but not at theta is zero. So I have this sort of situation where, as long as I don't look at the whole of space, I can integrate up f is q sine theta d theta wedge d phi, but I can't do it globally. So this is saying so this is, if you like, where we get a slight glitch in this duality relation. We have this, what looks like a duality between F and F dual, but once we have chosen what our fundamental gauge field is, in other words, what charges do our fundamental particles carry, and once we decide that our fundamental particles are electrically charged, then we've kind of made our choice. And so here we're saying that, you know, yes, we can find a gauge potential for F, but only locally, not globally. And so it's saying there's something a little suspect, but there's something sort of slightly off kilter about our monopole solution. So let me just make a note that the A south is A north minus q, 2q d phi. So I do have a gauge transformation. The relationship between the two gauge patches is a gauge transformation. So it's sort of saying things are consistent, but it's a gauge transformation that's not regular on either axis. So that's kind of the setup of this monopole. So let's sort of see what this might say for the Kaluza-Klein monopole. So, I probably should say that what this is kind of touching on here is a sort of branch of mathematics, which is, is it cohomology? I can never remember. Where the sort of question is, if df is zero, can you write f equals dA? If you can do that globally, then your space sort of is now, at least from the perspective of f, is simply connected. If you can't, it's like you've got a hole in it. And so the hole is, of course, the black hole here. So from a Kaluza-Klein perspective, we're looking for a metric with this term for the extra dimensional piece. So we take that form for the metric in the top left-hand corner. We know that our extra dimensional part has to have the form d psi plus a, where psi is our extra dimension. And it's going to have that form either for the north A or the south A. So we suspect there's a psi north and a psi south. And then we go through, we look at the Einstein equations for the phi field and the G field, given this A, and solve. So this is what you get for the solution. If you write q squared as r plus r minus, then you find that you have two possible horizons, r plus and r minus. So the mass, if you like, or the gravitational mass of this solution is something to do with the difference between r plus and r minus. And q squared is just the combination. So that's what the Kaluza-Klein magnetically charged solution is. And I can use that space. But what is interesting now is these two patches here for the gauge field translate into two coordinate patches for this psi field. So our two coordinate patches are a coordinate patch that doesn't include the south pole axis and a coordinate patch that doesn't include the north pole axis. And from our definition of a manifold, we know that on the overlap, our coordinate two different coordinate patches have to be related by a C infinity transformation. And of course, here we know what this is. Because we saw that the difference between the north and south gauge patches was 2q phi, 2qd phi. So that tells us that our coordinate transformation is simply add a multiple of phi to our extra dimension coordinate psi. But now something interesting happens because phi has periodicity 2 pi. So if I go from phi to phi plus 2 pi, I get back to the same point. And so the psi south has to be the same when I add 4 pi q. So this tells me that there's a specific periodicity of my extra dimension in terms of the charge, and actually could be over n, because all I know is that 4 pi q has to be a multiple of the periodicity of psi. So I could either say that this, the charge of the magnetic monopole sets the periodicity of the extra dimension, or in fact, once I know the size or how the periodicity of my extra dimension, my magnetic monopole charge is quantized. So this notion of charge quantization is actually was first spotted in a rather different context by Dirac in the 30s when he was thinking about why is electric charge quantized? Because what he noticed was he thought, well, what if there's a magnetic monopole? If there's a magnetic monopole, then let's say he was thinking about the north gauge patch, AN, then he noticed that AN was regular everywhere except for the negative z-axis. And so he figured, well, okay, so the gauge field is infinite. Is that a physical problem? Does it matter if a gauge field becomes infinite? Because what is relevant is the physical quantity, which is F, and F is finite at the South Pole. So he decided it's okay to have this infinity as long as it has no physically measurable consequences. So that singularity on the south axis became called the Dirac string. So how could you observe something with the gauge field? Well, not directly from electromagnetism, but of course, the reason you are interested in electromagnetism is because many fundamental particles are charged. So if you scattered electrons off a magnetic monopole and they reacted to that singularity, that Dirac string, then it would be observable. So he looked at the wave function of the electron using his Dirac equation and found what the various particle states were, and noticed that provided the charge of the electron, or that there was a quantization condition between the charge of the monopole and the charge of the electron, then that string had no observable effects. So it's basically the same as this quantization condition. And so that was something that, you know, he found incredibly interesting, because he sort of said, well, you know, there just needs to exist a single magnetic monopole in the universe, and then you have quantization of electric charge. So I think we sometimes take for granted that charges are quantized, but Dirac was digging deeper. He wanted to understand and to have a mechanism by which some fundamental mechanism by which you would get quantization of charge. And so there's a nice sort of story here. In Dirac's case, he was just looking, obviously, at electromagnetism and fermions. But from our perspective here in gravity, we're looking just at geometry. And because, in essence, with Kaluza-Klein theory, what you're doing is actually concretely realizing the U1 gauge group of electromagnetism by that internal circle, you get this parallel between Dirac's very quantum motivated argument and this very geometrical discussion here. And it's kind of a cute correspondence.
Mm-hmm. May I ask you, where does the right corner metric come from? Is it from KK metric?
Sorry, where does what come from?
The metric.
Oh, I'm just saying that is the solution. So you put in that form over there on the left. Mm. You know, you kind of look for a block diagonal solution. You'd go through, you'd calculate Riemann, Ricci, blah, blah, blah. You'd look at your Einstein equations in 5D. And you would solve them.
I see.
Okay?
Yes. So another question is, what is the difference between and the relation between the 5D and 4D charged black hole or magnetic black hole in 5D and 4D? I mean, 5D is a KK charge and 4D is the normal charge.
You mean the Reisner-Nordström black hole? Well, you can kind of see that from here because there's no 1 over R squared terms, right? So the other thing you're seeing there is, again, this is not an area gauge. So I'm not actually going to write this down in terms of the Kaluza-Klein solution because I want to discuss something a little more interesting about it. But if you know, what you would do is you'd now take the form I've written there. You know what your scalar field is by just reading off what G psi psi is. And so then that will tell you what the four-dimensional Kaluza-Klein metric is, because you kind of just would multiply by 1 over the square root of 1 minus R minus on R.
Yes.
So it's still not in area gauge, whatever you do. Okay, so the reason why I think this is a very interesting solution, or one of these sort of bits of magic that occurs, is that you can see what the extrema limit is here. So the extrema limit is obviously R plus goes to R minus. The two sort of roots coincide. And when R plus becomes R minus, that factor in front of dt squared just goes away. So t is a time-like coordinate everywhere. It looks like the horizon is gone. So what's happened? Because it looks like, normally, that you would expect a singularity at R equals R minus. So has this become a singular limit like the electric black hole? So let's look at this particular limit. So now, because GTT is identically 1, you kind of have no active gravitational mass. So if you sort of ask how objects, you know, if you sort of set something at fixed distance from this source, it's not going to start moving. So here, Q, which is R plus, is L over 4 pi. I'm going to just pick this charge quantization to be 1, the sort of n in that to be 1. And I'm I'm going to group together all the angular pieces. So I'm counting the internal direction as an angle. So if I look at this extremal limit, I can actually just take my radial coordinate and sort of have something. Remember when we did the Euclidean black hole, we took the square root of r minus 2gm. So we're going to do something very similar here. So the analog here is thinking about that Euclidean black hole where we sort of take a proper distance, and we see that r ds squared is roughly dt squared minus d rho squared. So I'm now just rewriting my Kaluza-Klein coordinate by rescaling with respect to Q, so that this Kaluza-Klein coordinate has a periodicity of 4 pi. And remember, theta has a range of 0 to pi, and phi has a range of 0 to 2 pi. So what's interesting about this is this thing here is actually, without the rho squared, is actually the metric on a three sphere in Euler angles. So to see that, I write my three sphere in this particular form. So the three sphere is a surface in four Euclidean dimensions that's a constant distance from the origin. So that means I kind of want to do polars in four dimensions, but I choose to do them in a specific way. I split my four dimensions into 2 plus 2. So I have like co-orthogonal two planes. And then I split the my radial coordinate rho is obviously going to be the distance from the origin. But then I kind of split the magnitude in these two planes as cos theta on 2 and sine theta on 2. And then chi and phi are parametrizing the angles in those different two planes. So if you write it in this way, you will get this metric here. So it's fairly easy to see, though, that x squared plus y squared plus z squared plus w squared is rho squared. So you can see that it is indeed an S3. And so what this says is that this extremal limit is non-singular. And so normally when we think of Kaluza-Klein theory, we're adding a little circle to our manifold. So usually the topology that we get is whatever a manifold was cross an S1. However, here we are sort of adding a fibering our original manifold with an S1, but in a very non-trivial way. We're kind of doing it with a twist. So I sometimes like to think of this as in terms of chainmail. So the upper hemisphere is like a little bit of chainmail with the little rings of the chainmail. And the lower hemisphere is the, again, it's sort of like half an S2 cross the S1. But when I sew together the northern and southern hemispheres, I have to bear in mind that the angles, the relationship between the north and south psi angle is 2 phi in that sense. So what that means is as I stitch together these little sort of, if I identify the individual rings of the chainmail, I start at phi equals zero and they're one on top of the other, I move around and I'm gradually twisting as I identify till I get back to the beginning, and I've done this 2 phi twist all the way around. And so what that means is when I fibered by that S1 with that twist, instead of getting an S2 cross an S1, I've lifted my S2 into an S3. So this is what's called a hop fibration. So it's one of these nice little pieces of magic. S3 is also a very interesting manifold because it's a group manifold. So that you see, because those angles, theta, phi, and chi, are actually Euler angles. So Euler angles kind of parameterize SO3. So rotations in three-dimensional space are a particular rotation around a given axis. So your rotation, if you like, is phi, but then you have to specify where, which axis you're rotating around, and so that's specified by two angles. So that's kind of the idea. And S3 itself has two copies of SO3 or SU2 acting on it. So obviously a three sphere has a sort of SO4 symmetry, but that can be written as SO3 cross SO3 or SU2 cross SU2. Think about it in terms of the angles. So there's lots of kind of cute bits of mathematics to do with this Kaluza-Klein monopole. And so the people who kind of figured this out back, I guess, in the 80s were David Gross and Malcolm Perry, and also Raphael Sorkin, who's here at Perimeter. So this is sometimes called the Gross-Perry-Sorkin monopole. So I just want to finish off by coming back, if you like, to more or less where we started. I've talked about these black hole solutions, and in fact, I've talked about black holes in general, and at no time have I ever discussed whether they make sense, these solutions. In other words, are they stable? And that is in part because we're so used to the idea of a black hole being stable. But to prove a black hole was stable, is that there was actually quite a long story there. Because in order to prove something stable, you've kind of got to test it by looking at perturbations around the black hole. And so, again, in, I guess, the 50s, there was a long story of actually trying to find the perturbations of Schwarzschild and then to decompose them with respect to their angular momentum. And then, really, it wasn't until the 70s, if you like, that the definitive proof was nailed down. But we can ask the same question here. Because I think when people started looking at higher dimensional black brain solutions, there was a sort of assumption that they were stable because Schwarzschild is stable and you add an extra dimension, that just gives an effective mass, and mass always makes things more stable. However, let's ask this question by comparing our black string to a five-dimensional black hole. So let's ask whether there's some sort of mechanism that prefers one of these to the other. So remember, the radius of this is R4, and our compactification length is L, and here our radius is R5. So for this, for the black string, our mass the mass is just, R4 is just 2gm, but g there is the four-dimensional g, which is g5 on L. So the mass of our black string is linearly proportional to R4, and its entropy is 4 pi R4 squared L over 4g5. Which goes like m squared on L. Now, the black hole, its mass, if you refer back to our expressions for the mass of the five or n-dimensional black hole, so now, the mass of the five-dimensional black hole goes like its radius squared, whereas the entropy of the black hole goes like its radius cubed. So if I look at what the entropy does, the entropy goes like m to the 3/2. So here we've got, just looking at dependences, here we've got an m squared on L, and here we've just got an m to the 3/2. So you can kind of see that the behavior of the entropy of the two solutions is different. So let's compare the entropies. So the entropy of the black string, which was 4 pi m squared g5 on L, is 4 pi m squared g5 on L is, I can write it in terms of the entropy of the black hole, which is m to the 3/2, and that means I've got a square root of m left over. But now I want to replace gm by the size or the horizon radius of the black string. And I see that if I now compare the two entropies, depending on the relative size of the horizon radius of the string to the compactification length, the black string could have greater or less entropy. And roughly speaking, if L is very small, the black string has more entropy. If L is very large, the black hole has more entropy. So for R4 less than 16L over 27 pi, the black hole has higher entropy. So that suggests that if I try to make either the compactification length too long or the black string too skinny, then I enter a regime in which the black hole should be preferred. And so that tells me that the black string is probably unstable. And indeed, this entropy argument does correspond to a classical instability of Schwarzschild cross R. So So you do a linearized perturbation analysis around this black string solution, and it's an S-wave instability. So the string kind of becomes something like this. Starts to waver, and then eventually it kind of forms a whole array of black holes. So that's the black string instability. So that was something found by myself and Ray LaFlamme, who is the IQC guy. So he's now a quantum computational guy. But this was way back when we were students, essentially, or just out of students, being students. So it's a really nice example of where black hole thermodynamics, which, let's face it, is a sort of, you know, a bit of a prayer, because we don't really know for sure that we can do, you know, quantum, that it makes sense to sort of split this quantum field theory on a classical background. We're talking of entropy of black holes. The way in which I've justified the entropy to you is all sort of either by analogy or looking at this sort of rather flaky Euclidean quantum gravity type approach. And yet by using entropy, it tells us that a particular configuration is not preferred. And then you go and look at classical gravity, no quantum, no H bar anywhere. And you see indeed there's a linear instability. So it's sort of saying that black hole thermodynamics, although it's not been proven, is definitely, you know, that it's not that it's just some sort of slightly dubious excursion into trying to do quantum things with gravity. It does seem to genuinely correspond to real physical properties of gravitational systems. So I'll stop there.